Killer Keller podcast. KillerKellerOfficial.com.
You need the Kellervision app. 24/7 mini documentaries, podcasts, live shows, DJ live streams, top fives, subscription packages, plus products for all your podcasts and street culture sports. Download it from the App Store for free today.
Beatbox created.
Killer Keller.
And we're here to talk about world music and street culture.
Killer Keller podcast.
This is it. This is the centre of bigness.
Yeah, it's the centre of bigness. Ladies and gentlemen, Killer Keller Podcast, live and direct, Central London, or Central as you need to be. You know the coup. You know the deal. You know what we're trying to do here. It's the street culture, huh? It's sport and art. And big shout out to Graffiti Kings. Hold tight, everyone, on the Kellervision app. Free download, you know the deal. Yeah, sport and art. And no one holds more medals in production across the generations. High level, ranging from Massive Attack, Sugar Babes, All Saints, Naina Cherry, Cameron McVeigh inside the place.
Wow.
Tell me about that.
What, being here?
Tell me about how it feels to reflect on an introduction like that and then think, fuck.
Well, no, before that, trust me, there's one before. I live kind of quite near Trellick, and on top of our garages, there's an allotment, you know, because he was quite a clever guy, the guy there. The Goldfinger, and
Goldfinger, yes,
yeah, proper man, but yeah. Apparently a bit grumpy. But the girl that runs the allotment, she's great. And we were sitting up there chatting, and I was unloading the car, and she saw I had a disc for sales on Madness is One Step Beyond album, which I did the photograph for.
So, what?
Yeah, that's my photograph.
Yo, Legacy Holding, come on.
But the thing is, I gave her the disc because I don't like hold discs. And I told her to scrub out my name and put her name on it. So she sent me a photograph a little bit later on the phone, and she'd written over the top of my name in pink, Ruby. And I was like, yeah, baby. She put it on the wall in her house. I was really proud.
I'll go with that.
Okay. But before that, I used to be a fashion photographer. So, you know, in fact, I used to direct MTV before MTV Europe existed.
Stop in a minute. Hold on. Look, this is what we're dealing with here. You know what I mean? Like, I've only known you for a small chapter of your life. It's a life of many lives, isn't it, essentially?
And we bump into each other in strange places, as we just discussed before we came on air.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. It's almost like worlds are constantly in a line, isn't
colliding.
It? Yeah.
Nice way.
I like it. Well, actually, the last time was actually in crossing, big up Trellick Tower, hold tight. Just
cross my phone. On my phone, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, all day. You were walking the dogs, weren't you? And with your
Mabel's dogs.
That's it. Hold tight, Mabel.
Hold tight, Mabel.
Of course.
Big Mabel, just about to drop a record, which is huge. It's literally dad sing along record.
It's certified.
But yeah, before I did this, I was a photographer, and I used to take pictures, and I got a bit. I did fashion. I worked for Vogue, did brides, worked at Condé Nast, assisted up at Vogue Studios, worked all over the world as an assistant, became a photographer. Then I started doing cheap commercials, which is called rostrum photography, which is basically You take a load of stills and then they film them with a camera. So people who can't afford to shoot a commercial, they run them in the old days. And I used to work for Goldbergs and Riggs, which is like Selfridges and Miss Selfridges in Glasgow.
That rings bells, man. I saw it on BBC Four. I'm an avid BBC Four watcher, man.
There you go. So so basically, Terence Donovan, who was one of the great three from the 60s, Bailey Donovan and Duffy, he was my producer. Really lovely man. Big up Dan Donovan, who's used to be Big Old Audio Dynamite. And a big man from West. Ooh. Yeah, see. And so Terence, God rest his soul, he was my producer, and he started me off doing that. Then we directed commercials, and then the MTV people came along via Miles Copeland, who was Stuart Copeland, the drummer in The Police's brother and manager.
Damn, yeah. Jeez.
Whose other brother was the head of the CIA.
No way.
Yeah, little known fact.
Really? Yeah. You know, we're going to have a bunch of little known facts coming in.
So it goes on. So basically, Miles was doing the reports from London music scene. It was around about the time of Spandau Ballet. We don't need no pressure on that time. Me and my friend Jamie Morgan, big up Jamie Buffalo, we'd kind of just been basically running Buffalo, which is, you know, Ray Petrie, the great Ray Petrie, myself and Jamie. We were the three original Buffalos. And so Jamie and I were doing lots together. Jamie had basically taken my cameras and taken on my career when I decided I didn't want to take pictures anymore. And we ended up, Miles Copeland came to us because they wanted some kids who knew about the music scene, and we knew what we were doing, kind of thing. And he ran two campaigns, and we did the treatment, obviously, because we were the kids, and our one was a big success. And so we ran it for ages, like doing reports of the London music scene, like once a month.
Wow, so you like, I mean, talk about Kellervision. You were the prototype, you were the original.
Well, no, this is much more professional than us. Actually, I did live, with the first show, I didn't know what live vision mixing is. You know, when you do the thing and they're mixing three cameras. And our vision mixer was Rod Story, who's the most amazing vision mixer. And she taught me what, because I turned up and I didn't know what I was doing. She went, "You have got no idea." Everyone went, "No." And she said, "You know, thank God you gave me that answer." And then she just ran me through it. So I was directing live within 10 minutes.
You were learning as you were going.
Well, it was easy. You just say, camera one, close up, blah, blah, blah. It's just brilliant.
Vision mixing is incredible. If the hands-on approach to the way...
Well, football.
Yeah, yeah, there you go. Great example.
Yeah, good concepts. And she was great. And then the other thing was we directed videos. We did one of Status Quo. And I got told that I made them look too effeminate. So they never used the video.
Which video was it?
I don't remember. They weren't very nice people, to be honest. But we did loads of it. We did Hazy Fantasy. Remember them?
Yeah, of course. What was that tune? hold on. Dan from Cuts. He was in one of the music videos.
Yeah,
was that the one you're talking about?
Yeah.
Is that the video?
There's loads of people. I don't know if he was. I've known Dan since he was a kid.
Yeah, good people.
Big up Cuts.
Yeah, big up Cuts. So listen, we're going to get in some. Listen, we don't want it to all be if you don't know, you don't know. We're going to get in some details. So if at any point we start going off on one of these tangents where people haven't got a clue what we're talking about, we do have to kind of.
Well, you've got to go and look up Cuts. You've got to look up James LeBron.
All day, James LeBron. And Mark LeBron as well.
Mark LeBron, big up Mark LeBron, big up Crunch.
Legendary photographer. And
hey, Mark used to be my assistant.
No way.
Yeah, little and large. He was basically my assistant. When I had a photographic studio in Covent Garden, Mark was my assistant.
I'm going to tell you something, actually, Cameron, because it's come to my attention a bunch of times that when we talk about this level of street culture from back in the day to now and dealing with the clientele such as Judy Blame, Mark LeBron, Buffalo Movement, all these things, 80s Clubland, you know, Scarlett Cannon, these sorts of fashion icons.
Scarlett, big up Scarlett.
Big up Scarlett. You know, there's a lot of street artists, graffiti writers, who grew up in that era.
Yeah, Banksy.
Yeah, exactly. It's that era of...
Banksy's our friend.
They love these episodes. Yeah,
3D.
Like Goldie. Yeah.
I met all that lot with 3D.
K-1?
Yeah. Okay. I mean, we you know, they were all... In fact, Goldie turned up at my wedding with a huge tag canvas with Nena in massive great big letters. And right at the bottom, Cameron.
Is that good?
Goldie,
very good, Goldie.
Big up Goldie.
Your legacy's crazy, man. Right, where did it begin? Because a lot of people out there, especially the younger audiences, you know, they're not as privileged as Mabel, where you're able to have a conversation. This is a rare opportunity for us to really get into. How do you get yourself into these positions? And what was the beginning, man? Like, yeah, how did you begin? How did this all begin?
Well, I think because I did quite a lot of, I suppose you call it mentoring. But basically, like I tell people now, it's like you just got to say, okay, it can't be that difficult, and you just get yourself stuck in. I think the other thing is that, well, I trained at a profession really, like I used to be an athlete when I was younger, and so I took that concentration and dedication through maybe the more difficult part of my adolescence. And then I think the first thing I did was I got into photography. I got thrown out of college for dropping some acid, and I got thrown out. And so after 3 days, having been thrown out of school for burning down the geography classroom, so then I ended up wanting a job. And I thought, where am I going to meet the most girls? Photography. I went through the Yellow Pages, found a guy, he gave me a job. And that's how it started. And I think that's kind of what people forget. I think maybe the internet maybe scares people away from doing that because they feel like they're stalking.
Mm.
But you could, in those days, you used to be able to ring people up and go, "Look, my name's Cameron. Do you mind if I come around, see if I can blag you for a job?" And like 20 people would go, "No," but one person might. And then you could go in there and I don't know. I think that, you just sort of found your way in. And then you got taught, back in those days, you got taught to do things properly. So in photography, you learned all of the techniques. So I worked at the darkroom that looked after Condé Nast and Snowden and all those people, learned how to light properly. And then I learned when I started making music that all of those things were applicable in music as well. All of those same theories.
It's a recipe. It's a formation of things that happen.
Yeah, the sort of the whole thing of the, you know, focus and speed and parallax theory and all those things that apply in photography, they are actually the same with audio as well.
That's so cool. Because I always think the analogy of cooking recipes. But that visually, photography, same thing, isn't
Nana,
it?
Nana, my missus, everything is via cooking.
Hold tight, Nana, all day.
Big up, Nan. She, you know, she's literally the best cook in the world. And... her whole theory about being a chill person and how she does all her therapy through cooking and that is just, and that's what she's taught the kids, and that's the level in her life. It's like, and you know, all of those things are connected.
She did the cookery program as well, didn't she?
She did a couple of bits with Andy. Yeah, I mean, I don't think Nana was really a huge fan of doing telly. I think she finds telly a little bit shallow revs for her liking. No disrespect.
Shallow
to telly,
revs. I like that.
But I think that Nana goes a bit slower than telly can be. And the thing is, I think a lot of the time with those shows, fundamentally, I did this earlier, doesn't really work for Nana. This is something I met, you know what I mean, that whole thing. And Nana's whole thing, she goes in deep. So she's writing a book at the moment and the depth is, it's unbelievable.
She's great for podcasts because literally, like you say, deep dive.
Tangents is her thing. Huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's the whole thing. The book is about the thing and then it's the thing with the add-ons and the add-ons are the thing, you know
what
I mean?
Yeah,
my life. Welcome to my life. That's like, I live with someone who doesn't finish a sentence or makes it into a book. It's like...
I'll read about it later, just carry on.
But she researches her songs really heavily. So when we go into a song, she's in deep. So she's making a documentary every tune. So it's great. That taught me my shit, you know?
Yeah.
But that's what kids need to know right now, is that everybody needs to do their research. You've got the biggest library in the world available to you right now. It's not just for porn. It's there for other things too. Yeah. Porn's great, but...
Yeah, for real. No, for real as in like, it's...
Well, not all porn's great.
No, some of it can be quite crap. Actually, you know, back to the point about...
That's the porn of it. Yeah,
no, that's the actress said to the bishop. Facebook was built on horny boys wanting to connect with girls. I think it's ironic that now the internet has suddenly put a frown upon, you know, a mark on the idea of that sort of behavior.
There's a whole thing going on at the moment. It's currently credible for government officials to divert away from the shit they're getting up to by saying, okay, what's going on in schools is terrible, they're not protecting girls, and blah, which is true, which has always been true.
It's not like girls
haven't always been sexually assaulted by every single boy in the school and talked about behind their backs.
Yeah,
it's
that's
just
right.
The level of exposure of it now is too much. And the habitual scrolling thing. Not big up the man who invented scrolling, I've got to say, poor bloke. He's probably really guilty now. Probably hung himself one day, or if he hasn't already, because it's a terrible thing, isn't it? Because this is...
And it's all you got.
Yeah, and I think that's bad. But the whole thing of, like, people, even though it's available, right, and you can go and do the stuff that needs shaming, I think that it isn't necessarily something we have to gravitate to. What we need to learn is that you need to not do it all the time. You need to work out the time for it and the time not for it. And that's what they don't teach you in school. And that's what is bad, I think. I don't think that sex education in school is ever anything but embarrassing.
Exactly.
You can't say the word fuck at school. You don't learn the word love at school. Yeah, how many times you learn the word... Do you ever hear the word love at school ever?
Never. It's true. It's
come
very
first,
true.
Be the best.
Yeah.
Stand in line.
They don't teach you about money. They don't teach you about debt. They don't teach you about credit cards. They don't teach you about that shit.
They don't teach you about fuck shit. They don't teach you about, like, you know, what your penis should look like. They don't teach you about what you should be, you know, how you should rest, how to meditate, how to read a book properly, how to hug your friends, how to look after each other. Right? How to look after each other is a fundamental thing in life. You need to, you know, at nursery school, it's like, I remember being my first day at nursery thinking, whoa, this is wrong, man. And I never settled at school for after that, right, all the way through. Never. Such a waste.
Wait, did it as a young... As young Cameron, was that...
Young Cameron.
As a young Cameron, as a early teens, like you would, you mentioned you burnt down the
burnt down the geography room.
Geography room. So was this like...
Got a nick for it.
Really?
I punctured every single tyre and every single teacher's when I left. And now I'm a famous old boy for that school. There's only two of us, and which is ridiculous because I'm not famous. And the other one is the head of, like, worldwide head of the biggest music corporation in the world. And he's a despicable man. I won't say his name. And it's just like when they tried to publicise that, I went down and said I'd sue them if they...
Associate you with that.
Yeah, and I took all my medals out of the cupboard and all my cups that I won from when I was running. And I hated the place. And I nearly killed myself there. It was horrible.
Yeah,
and I think that a lot of kids, more than 50% of kids through history in this country, don't get educated properly.
They don't, do they?
No, man. One of my grandkids, he was having a hard time in Hackney. In the end, we had to put him through school. We had to shell out some grandparent money to look after him, and now he's cool. But looking at what they offered him in state school and so-called yuppie kind of, you know, I won't say the word Steiner, but Steiner schools, wrong the way he was treated.
Yeah.
And every kid in the world should be afforded the ability to learn how to be a human.
Yeah.
It's a scary thing being alive, right?
The other thing is, and the other thing as well is like it's not you're steered away from being creative, you're steered away from having your own creative thoughts and challenging the status quo of what you're being taught.
You're told to, you know, you're told to get fit into the grinder, get down the plug hole.
Yeah. Bottleneck, motherfucker, get in.
There are three things in life. This is one thing my mum taught me really early on, because my mum was blind, right? So I grew up with a blind mother, so she always kind of had to, we had to deal with an alternative way of growing up. And right. My mum said, big fish, small fish, big pond, dig your own pond. And I was a pond digger, and like my whole family are pond diggers. And you just can't be, you know, you don't want to be any of those. Because if you're a big fish in a small pond, you're going to be a bully.
Yeah.
If you're a small fish in a big pond, you're going to get bullied. Yeah. And if you dig your own pond, you make your own rules.
That's right.
And you can be nice, right, if you're in your own pond.
Yeah, absolutely. You dug your own pond. That's just everything that your mother said.
Here's to her own ponds. Yeah, well, my mum had to dig her own pond because she, you know, would get thrown off the bus because they didn't want to take the guide dog. You know, in the pouring rain in the morning when she was going to work at the hospital where she worked, people would not let her on the bus because they didn't want to get the bus dirty with her. But people were horrible, you know, people were horrible to her.
You see the real side to people sometimes, don't you?
But again, I don't think it's them. I just think it's people go a bit doolally because they haven't been hugged that morning or that whole childhood or their whole life. There should be a hugging lesson at school.
Totally, totally. With your skill sets, it sounds to me like you... And we're talking early now. So I'm trying to go through, like, I'm trying to create a timeline that kind of measure for measure goes through your career trajectory. And I'm like thinking, where did you get the ability to fill out a creative, for instance, photography? That, especially when you deal with the processes of creating, that's just not a normal... You've got to do the 10,000 hours and have a keen eye.
You've got to... Well, I suppose I got the keen eye because I was always describing stuff to my blind mother.
Of course.
Right, and so we're like... So that was, you know, you do tend to be... And that's also where I learned to tell stories and write lyrics, because my mum would listen to audiobooks the whole time and I would have to be describing stuff to her. And so that worked both of those things. I mean, that's an unfair advantage for any human.
Yeah.
And then you learn to be protective because you're with someone that you've, you know... If you walk along with me now along the street, I might go up, down when we come to the curb. Still all these years later, she's been dead for years and I still do it by mistake sometimes, because when we come to the curb, I don't want to see her fall down and...
Oh, that is so sweet.
But then I think that you...
Great.
But your skill set comes about through necessity, because my dad died when I was really young and I had to start fending for the family. So you learn to combine... But you don't want to do... I figured early on that you want to be doing what you want to do. Mm. Probably only going to get a couple of years to run at it. So go and do the things that you want to do. Learn really fast, but learn the process really fast. So get in, get involved, do the research, study it. Be radar from MASH, you know, have the...
You thing. Hearing this, people?
Well, you know, radar from MASH is the man, right? Because he always had everything before he was asked for it. So, you know, be the best you can be, even if it's a menial task. If you're going to sweep up, have it done so no one's going to tell you to sweep. Do it.
So true.
Because getting told is so belittling. So then get done, 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 do, research, be there, ask for more. You're going to learn more, and then that's how you do it. And then the energy of that is that you just, you know... And then also the other side of that, which I learned... maybe too late in life, is learn to turn off, learn to shut down, learn to meditate, learn to have a space of nothing, because otherwise you're going to go pop. And I've gone pop a few times and I've seen people around me pop.
I'm one of those kind of popping types.
Well, we all pop. I think that's the creative. Creative people pop. It's just, for how long do you pop?
Yeah.
And can you get back from your pop? And
how long is the recovery time of popping?
Yeah. And are you going to learn from that recovery? You're going to pop again, you know, and it's like... You know, because it's inevitable, but you just have to learn those rules. And I think I wish I'd learned to meditate when I was a young'un, and I wish I'd learned to stretch when I was a young'un.
Stretching, man, no joke.
Because I'm old now and not very flexible, and you know, I have to... Stretching really fucking hurts.
Yeah. I mean, they tell us all the time in the gym. They tell us that every morning when you wake up, that's something you should be doing. It's all these, like you say, it's the pop analogy, isn't it? Like you can do as much as you can. Like you say, you're very much the hands-on, let's go, I'll do it before you've even asked, type thing.
But also empower everyone around you as well. So like the thing with me is that always be in a room where the people are really great and try to just let them be really great. So like I've been around to do loads of great things, some really great records or whatever, but I was around a lot of great people and there wasn't that much to do. Because if you're around really great people, you don't really even have to say anything. You're just there for each other. And if you know enough about the medium to know how great they are, then you afford them the ability to be themselves. And then if you have something to give, then less is more. And every now and again, when you contribute something, then it's... So like, you know, I've worked on some really difficult sessions as well, but because the people were so good, the difficulty didn't matter and you just get swept away.
You, as a producer, that's part of the... part of the task, isn't it? You've got to create enough energy for everybody in the room with the vision and explain explanation. That's explanation. What is this
and there's
about?
A certain amount of discipline, but like, that's just it's good parental discipline. So you have to learn to give people enough rope to not hang themselves, but definitely do something that you didn't expect. So it's quite a thing. I've enjoyed working with other producers and doing doubles, like double ups, and like mutual admiration. Like Dave Allen, that produced all the great Cure records, is someone I've worked with a lot, and we love being in the studio together because we've done some wild music together.
Bad man, producer.
Big up, Dave Allen. He's one of the greats.
Actually, you know what? We had a couple of sessions, you and me, for my second album with Sweet Irie. Do you remember?
Sweetie, man. Big up,
big up Sweetie. Yeah.
West London, massive.
He's another underestimated producer, man.
And a great human. Yeah. Pebble dashed his room in what's that French seaside town in the north of France? I can't remember what it's called. Biarritz, the surfing town. And we were there doing a gig with Nana. And Sweetie and me went out on a bender. And I woke up in the morning and he pebble dashed the whole room. He'd literally we had to smuggle him out. Right?
Love it. I can't imagine Sweetie being...
Well, imagine with, Sweetie drunk.
Yeah, that must be the most fun drunk ever.
Sweetie, man. Come on, just pebble dash my room.
Sweetie, you're going to have to come on and retaliate on this one.
No,
come
no,
on.
He did. You know what? I posted a tune the other day, me singing, and Sweetie was all over it, man. He's going to remix it, remold it, and come bring it back to me. He's a proper man.
He is so quick off the mark.
Well, he did. He put the Gorillaz on the map.
He'll do it. Yeah, without question.
Literally, Gorillaz wouldn't have taken off. I mean, big up Damon, but you know, all
Middle
the
Row
others,
crew. Yeah.
And Jamie and all that crew, but yeah, he definitely put them on the map with that remix.
Yeah.
Because they were struggling prior to that.
Yeah, they really were. Mm. No, I remember it so well. It was always on the radio. I'd be in my art class.
He's so commercial. He's like, because you know what Sweetie's thing is? Cool. He thinks like a cartoonist.
Yeah, he does.
His whole thing is, you can see inside his head, he's like a little cartoon weasel. And he's always thinking like, and he talks like it. And he's like, because he's all positive cartoons, you know.
Without question. Yeah, you're right. And even when he's in studio, his arms are flying. He's just quick. He's super quick. He's like... I can picture it now. I've done so many sessions.
No, he's good, and he reminds me of because I used to work in Jamaica a lot. I used to work with a lot of Jamaicans back in the day. I used to work with a lot of Jamaican musicians to make pop records.
They don't fuck about them guys.
No, but you know what? That's good about them. They're all like little cartoons, and so little pop things. Like working with Flabba Holt from Roots Radix, best bass player in my opinion ever. And he, you could like they're little cartoons, and Sweetie's like that with his lyrics and his whole little voices and sounds and little breaths and everything. Mm. Everything's another little color and a little. Mm. It's like a cartoon with more going on. So every time you go back, you get a little bit. Because it's yeah. Like with beatbox, when you have a little bit of spittle, makes the rhythm and a little thing, and you don't realize it.
The little click or something.
Yeah, it's the clicks of the thing.
Or even if it's just even just a.
I love it when you can get a really great vocalist to get the snot dripping at the right time. It's like that's part of a great vocal for me. Mm. You know what I mean? It's
like, 1000%. Yeah. Right. So when
a
it comes
snot dripper.
Well, just yeah, exactly. There needs to be like a sample pack for that.
Sorry about
Splice,
that.
Where you at? It's those little details, the attention to details that makes a great producer, isn't it?
Well, great.
Come on.
I mean, look, you know, the definition of a great producer for me is like a person who is adept at recognizing greatness and also is adept at being part of a team and is humble enough to recognize that they know nothing and they're not really in control. And that's the art of great parenting. You know, being a producer is like being a good parent. Basically, just my thing with parenting is I give up.
Mm.
What the fuck do I know? Don't do what I did and then you'll be all right. And it sort of works. And I think in the studio, if you walk in and just go, I don't fucking know. But when you're on it and you're producing a vocalist, you've got to know how to do what's necessary. So when you're working with singers, you've got to be able to be confident enough that if you go up and prod someone in the abdomen, it's not offensive, it's an aid, and you're teaching people how to breathe and just how to relax and find themselves. Because you've got to be able to put them in a place of confidence rather than just bursting their bubble. So, and that's the same, again, being a parent. You know, you've got to say no sometimes, but it's how you say no, isn't it? And why you say no and when you say no and in what voice you use to say no. And no doesn't have to be the word no.
Mm. You've got quite a bohemian life. I remember going round to your house many years ago, and it was just so
chaos. Is probably the worst.
No, not really. I mean, Judy was kind of perched on the corner, like big
Judy.
Up Judy Blame.
I miss Judy Blames. You know what I was thinking? Brett Walker, big up Brett Walker, the photographer, did the last picture of Judy.
No way.
And Judy, he's posted it online yesterday, amazing. And I just cried. Yeah, because I was Judy's primary palliative care nurse.
That's right, you were looking after him the whole
time. Yeah, me and the crew. And
big up Dave Baby as well, who's also in on set, Naina.
Dave Baby and I camped in Judy's house for a month after Judy died, just me and him.
Yeah,
I lived in the laundry cupboard, and Dave was downstairs on a couch, and we had a cowboy movie festival for a month. Big up Dave Baby.
Dave Baby.
Oh man.
Big up Carly as well.
Big up Carly. Big up, yeah, but you know, they're fucking hell, so many great people.
But this is the thing, and like a lot, I remember being around your place on a very few times, but very privileged times, because it was almost like, come on, come all, be free. The calamity, the, like you say, the boheme, just organized chaos of it. All of a sudden, someone will run in and then they go, and you're like, you don't even know if they live there or not. It's that kind of thing. You know?
Well, now we're, you know,
Keats was there as well.
Keats, big up Keats. I saw her last night, actually. Yeah. But, you know, they're like, well, Keats was down with us in, and so was Judy. Back in the day when we moved to Aller Inn, because we just needed to get out of London for a while. So we went to this roughneck Spanish town in the south of Spain. We all just moved down there. Mm-hmm. And the story of how and why is nuts. But Keats went to school down there. Andy Oliver, big up Andy, she was down there. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Tricky came and lived down there. Judy lived in an apartment in town in Aller Inn. This little Spanish random town had all of those same people lived in Aller Inn.
Give me the fucking tickets. All
right, well, we're going back. Nana and I are going back there on Sunday, and we basically haven't lived there since we moved out in, like, I don't know, 96.
It's going to be a trip.
Well, we bought a house down there, so we're going to go. We bought like an old little rundown Spanish little kind of shed, and we're going to go and live back down there for a while just to see how, what, why, where, and when. Man. Nana's dad died in the same valley. So Nana's dad died in that valley. Mabel was born in there. She's Malagueña.
Wow.
So Juan Pablo Picasso was born in Malaga. He's Malagueño. He was Malagueño.
There's a big magnetism of pull that's, you know, for every good reason is sending you that way.
Have you ever been there, Malaga City? Malaga City's happening. It's probably the kind of funkiest place in Spain right now.
Really?
Yeah, it's big. It's a big city, and it's old, and it's kind of a lot of gypsies, a lot of Africans. You know, the Moors and the Andalus fought so much in those days when the Arab versus the Catholic thing was going on. In the end, they just gave up. And there's a place called Cordoba where in the middle of the mosque, this is a true story, it's still there, you can go there. In the middle of the mosque, there is a Catholic cathedral. In the middle of the mosque.
No
I swear.
Way.
It's nuts. It's also the last place in the world where they have a British Home Stores, which is weird, in Cordoba, yeah. But there's in the middle, so you go in the mosque and you see all of that tradition, and in the middle, suddenly you're going into Catholicism.
Nah, that's mad.
They just went, yeah, fuck it, let's just give up.
See, that's how groovy this place gets, see? That's mad. That's mad.
And the thing is, from Aller Inn, where we are, the other great thing is you can see the Atlas Mountains across the water. Whoa. So on a clear day, you can see Atlas.
Beautiful.
And you can see Africa, basically.
Home's always been important for you and in creating, having a creative space, isn't it?
Well, Nana's an African, so it's important for her to be able to see it because she comes from Sierra Leone. So.
Yeah.
And then I spent a bit of time, I won't tell you doing what, but you can probably guess, down in Morocco back in the day when I was younger and, you know, doing little runs. So, I think home is important, and we've always worked at home because we didn't have any money. And we had some managers that kind of, you know, what managers do back in the day. So we hadn't got any money to pay a manager. So we had to have the studio in the house. And so that's what the tradition we carried on. So every time in the old days, you used to get record advances back before dinosaurs existed. And when you got a record advance, you bought a house and then you did the record in the house. And that way you built up your kind of house catalogue.
Mm.
That's when we became property tycoons.
Yeah. Right. Pause there because I want to go back a little bit. Okay. We'll get back to that bit in a second. I think for a lot of people, especially me right now, I'd like you to go back, if you can, back to a more new romantic era, a new two-tone era, an era where the 80s was kind of doing its thing, merging, and you were on the crest of all that activity, West End Soho, West End
Lived
London.
Lived in Soho.
Yeah, exactly. So there was all this interaction. You saw it from the... You were on the front line.
So does that exist now, do you think? Do you think that kids have got... I think that it's around now. I think that detail is around. But yes, I was around.
Oh, I want you to explain it from a...
It was all based around clubs. So there was the Hot Sty, which was Slits, Float Up CP, what was Nana's? Rip Rip and Panic. So all of that crew. So big up Sean Oliver, rest in peace. All that lot, Gareth Sega, all those crazy kids, you know, and Ari, big up Ari, bless her, miss her. So like all those people ran it, and Rose... massive, you know, like Rose. So all those people ran a club, and then Jamie and I did the we had a club in where the Wag became the club. We had a little one night there. Then the Wag ran there. I lived around the corner from the Wag, so I could walk there. So everything was based around that area.
Mm.
And then Steve Dagger and Graham Ball, who were the kind of managers around Spandau Ballet, they went to the London School of Economics. I think most people were art school or London School of Economics.
Right.
And then there was Chris Sullivan and Ollie that ran the Wag after me and Jamie kind of gave up on it. And then everything kind of centered around
it. Why did
there.
You give up on it? What was that? What kind of policy was it? What music were you playing? What was the vibe?
I mean, we just wanted to invite all our friends and have a laugh. And I think probably when we were there, it just was too much of a laugh. We got booted out. Yeah. Whereas Chris and Ollie were a bit better at disguising it.
What kind of music was it? What kind of?
Well, we were into kind of like, okay, so Jamie liked his kind of Manchester electronic factory kind of music.
Yeah.
Okay. And I was just discovering, and I'd always been in, all of us were really into reggae music because of Ray Petra in Buffalo, because he turned us all onto our reggae. We used to spend a lot, like we used to try and go on holiday to Jamaica as much as possible. And so we used to play a lot of reggae music. Reggae was our thing. And we used to go to Weasel Shebeen in Acklam Road.
Yeah.
In fact, Nana and I used to be at Weasel Shebeen most nights, and we didn't even know each other, and we never met each other once. Although it, it took until we met at Heathrow Airport years later. But then, so that scene was really much Spandau Ballet. It was all these groups, and Chris Sullivan had his group called what were they called? I can't remember what they called. Then there was Toby and Funk Apollo, and there was a few groups. There was like trendy kids that had groups. Some of them hit. Jade was part of that scene, and some of them hit like her and Spandau hit, obviously, and some of them didn't. Mm. And
I heard that Sade did pretty good, didn't she?
Yeah. She's, I mean, you know, so that, so
was
yeah.
Boy George and that lot, was that
George was around, yeah, that was, yeah, and Tony was DJing at the Wag.
Yeah.
And so Fat Tony, big up Tony.
What was the fashion? Because you
well, the Buffalo, everyone was different, but I mean, we were Buffalo, so you know, my whole thing was really Ray. So at the time, we were wearing tracksuit bottoms, gold, medals from the Olympics, Buffalo jackets, so the MA1 jacket over the top of a t-shirt. Everyone was kind of looking fairly like you had to go to the gym, definitely, you weren't allowed to look like you couldn't slack.
Please explain that for the people outside of the UK, especially, and for those that may not know from a fashion point of view how iconic this was. Explain the Buffalo movement, explain the Buffalo scene.
Well, okay, so Ray Petrie's kind of heritage was he basically started male fashion in the kind of macho sense. Prior to Ray, male fashion was a little just whack and it was a little traditional, and Ray just came from, you know, being gay and you know, really observant and really he basically was into really, really kind of hard and fit looking guys. So for instance, Nick Kamen, who's the original, who just died actually, he was one of the original models. His brother Barry, big black Jack from Paris, who was like really, who runs kind of all of the security now for all the French shows and everything, runs a massive security company. Big Black Jack Negri, he's amazing. All these kind of amazing looking guys, and they were just tough.
Stud,
yeah. But really fit, obviously male. Mm. And they were, a lot of them were definitely not white. And they were suddenly being into a lot of magazines. And so that had never happened before. I think it was quite racist and quite white. You never saw black models at all.
No.
And then Naomi Campbell came through that scene.
Yeah.
So I've just got an itchy nose. Hang on.
Sorry.
Got hay fever. So
can you just put that in? We'll get that as a sample pack ready to go.
Yeah, exactly. you know, so that, and then Ray's whole thing was, you know, he had a byline, he had music, and he was one of the first people to die of AIDS. So you know, he actually did the Paris fashion shows with copper sarcoma, the big purple cancerous blotches all over his body.
Really?
Proud front row.
Wow.
And nobody even like, he just, it was you know, it was high fashion death.
Wow, that is life creating art.
He was tough. I was with him when he got the diagnosis. It was pretty out there.
Wow. I mean, I speak to Scarlett Cannon about this, that the 80s was also an era of such horrific atrocities with HIV and AIDS, with all these different new illnesses that were coming into play that would, you know...
Just the same as everything. I think sensationalism has always sold media, and so it's easier to say something offensive and controversial if you want to sell a copy. So you know if it wasn't for controversy, then idiots like Laura Kunzenberg wouldn't exist. So it's like, you just, you know, anyway, Ray was kind of above all that, and he kind of, and a lot of current fashion, both male and female, is still based on his genius, because it was so simple. And the Face magazine was the sort of hub of that fashion. So we did the Felix Howard killer cover, which was the hat, port pie hat, Jamie Morgan photograph.
Yeah, that was killer. Cool, dude.
Lizzie Tear in the Vietnam helmet with a cigar.
Before ID magazine and all this sort of
stuff. Well, ID was because Terry Jones that started ID was the art director at Vogue when I worked at Condé Nast. Barney Wong and Terry Jones were the famous, and Grace Coddington was the editress. And so he came from the Vogue Condé Nast tradition. And so ID had that class behind it and that training.
Yeah.
And then he went and did ID with the kids.
Transferred, yeah.
And that's why ID was, until it was bought. I don't know, you know, it was, I mean, it's still great, but it's not, you know, none of these things are great when they become franchised, but you just can't, because the attention to detail is there, not there. But, you know, when Nick Logan had the Face, that Ray and Jamie were basically the major contributors from the point of view of fashion. Mm. Ray was ostensibly the fashion editor of the Face magazine.
Wow.
And then it was just an era, really concentrated era. So then the music at that time was heading towards being, you know, more melting pot. Mm. Hence the reggae music influence behind Culture Club, for instance. Hence the funk behind Spandau Ballet. Hence the reggae music and the ska music behind Madness. It was all just a melting pot. So he was just observing and also contributing. So it's hard to say chicken and egg, really. They were all part of each other's thing. And then I came along because I had my observation training because of my working for Vogue and everything. So everything that came along, I could sniff it out like a bad fart. So I was just chasing this and chasing that and then going, yeah, that's, you know. So, I mean, I literally ended up being Madness's road manager. So did the picture by accident. Just because I was following them around the country, checking the music
bonkers.
Out.
Just bonkers.
Yeah, I was the road manager on the Two Tone tour.
And I might add as well, if you know of the tune Buffalo Stance by Nina Cherry.
That's a lot later.
It's a lot later, but that's where it derived from. It was the it was more of a statement. It was a way of life.
Well, basically, Nana
exercising. You know,
Ray recognised that Nana was a powerful human and had an amazing aura and an amazing look, and he took a few of us to appear in a series of shows and fashion exploitations in Tokyo for a thing called Men's Biggie. There's a guy called Takeo Kikuchi, who's quite a famous designer in those days from Japan.
Okay.
So we all went there, and that's when Nana's thing started to gel, because that's when her previous training as a human became suddenly interesting to the fashion community. And so that Buffalo Stance thing came out of the comment of Buffalo, and then we just used Nana to front it, basically.
Mm. Game changer.
In fact, Buffalo Stance was actually a B-side to a boy band record that I did with Jamie for a laugh. We formed this boy band called Morgan McVeigh. We did this tune that is so embarrassing. And it's called Looking Good Diving. If you want to laugh,
we'll find it.
Go on the internet, look for Looking Good Diving, Morgan McVeigh. Mm. It's basically, we were the forerunners to Bros. It was so embarrassing. But then we needed a B-side.
That's fantastic.
No, I love it. We made it at Stock Aitken Waterman Studio because I'd been working there. So I had the chance to make it there. And that's where I kind of learned a lot of my chops in that world. And then we needed to do a B-side. So I just thought, well, let's put Nana on there. Come on, let's just... And so Nelly Hooper produced the Soul to Soul.
Big up Nelly Hooper.
Well, Nelly, you know, Nels kind of came up with the concept of...
Only around the corner, isn't it? On Salisbury, that was where the old studio was. Was that, am I thinking right?
Well, we did Buffalo... Well, the original of Buffalo Stance we did on... Now, where did we cut the original? No, the original that we cut was just Nelly cutting up tape, and then we put Nana on a demo, and then Tim Simonon from Bond the Bass went in and reproduced it and made it into a single.
That's why it sounds like a kind of club mix.
But it had club versus indie versus my kind of reggae thing, and the lyrics were kind of me and Jamie doing our pop thing, and it was just funny.
Well ahead
and
then of Nana, time,
had, it? Oh, I mean,
like
it was just another one of those things where we dug our own pond.
Yeah.
It's just another pond dig. And then a lot of other things. But then also because we did it, and then Nana got knocked up, because Nana and I started seeing each other, and then she got pregnant. And then we had a record coming out, and it went on fire, and the record company needed an album. And we'd have to wait until after the baby. And Nana was like, what the fuck? Why can't I go on Top of the Pops pregnant? And then that became iconic.
Yeah.
And then, you know, we just sort of basically, we still didn't have any money. We had bailiffs coming around even after we had our first hit. Ray was dying of AIDS at that time, so we kind of had to, you know, Tyson was on the way.
Wow.
And Ray was dying. Then Judy came in to take over from Ray, because Ray nominated Judy to take over. Strictly speaking, Buffalo should have carried on and Judy should have just taken over running it. But you know how the people get, and it just didn't work out. So, and me not being one to stick around, I just sort of moved into the next thing. But so then Judy became our Ray. And then Buffalo Stance came out, and then we started doing, you know, then in between singles one and singles two, Nana had the baby, and the baby from being in the belly was in the video.
Of course.
Exploiting our kids from an early age.
Hey, that's legacy right there.
Well, they got Paperboy.
And, yeah. And how many kids can you say, oh yeah, I was in my mum and dad's music video? That's gold.
She was bigging us up from the stage last night, Tyson, it's funny.
Yeah?
Yeah, well, you know, it's 30, she's 32 now.
That's mad.
That makes you feel old.
Yeah, all day. Yeah. I mean, there's not a day that goes by where I'm not starting to feel that way. Okay, so, right, now we're in the production world. Okay, so the Naina Cherry.
Well, we had to learn, you know, you do it yourself.
Yeah, and that's just the principle of it. And that's something that I think, you know, I hope you guys are recognising that if you're listening or watching, that you've most certainly, A, you've dug your own pond, but B, it's like you're reacting to mistakes and turning them into positives. You're making everything work.
It's all about filing, I think, life, isn't it? So if you keep a clean desktop, you've got to know where everything is. Because when you're going along, you hear this person do that and that person do that, and you've got to remember where it is, and at some point you've got to assemble it. And if you can't find it, you can't assemble it. So literally you have to remember where everything is. And so you have to have a good filing system, especially if you're as scatty as I am, or trying to do as many things as I try and do, which is just stupid. So you just literally have to know everything, where everything is. So when you're making an album, I suppose Raw Like Sushi was the first album I ever made. And like the way that I did it was, and I used loads of people to help me, but I never really went for any one thing. I just took the bits that I liked. And then this guy called Brian Chuck New, who was a great mix engineer, really taught me a lot, who was working at Zomba Studios, where I mixed the whole album down. And we just have all these, in those days, you had tape machines, and we had loads of 24-track tape machines. Slaves, they were called. So they were the extra bits, and then you were copying across from one tape to another and putting them down to a master tape. And so what Brian Chuck New was really good at doing was syncing everything up so it sat properly. And then I would go, right, I want that track there, I want a bass drum from there, I want the vocal off there, I want the string off that. And that's how we assembled everything.
Whoa.
And so that's kind of, because I could remember how my mum had to remember in the kitchen because she couldn't see everything. So you'd knock stuff over in your blind, right? So she would just have to file it away to know when she's walking from the door to there might be a pot of water, the kettle, something hot, is the flame on, blah, blah, blah. So that's what you're doing when you're making a record.
And for the photographic memory that you have, I guess it all... That
dwindles, and so as you got older, you just have to really make sure your systems are fail-safe, which they're not, as you know, because I didn't turn up yesterday, so...
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Well, what's yesterday when this is probably like a couple of weeks old, I believe. Respect, integrity... longevity, all these things, because I know you talk about having a good filing system, but when you're sitting in a mixing room in Zomba Records, what I'm musing, so please interject if you know, join in. I'm thinking, if you're sitting there with Stockacre and Waterman, if you're sitting there in Zomba Studio and the responsibility on you, right, there's not so much pressure on you, but it's that people around you clearly have, they know your pedigree, they know what you come up through, they expect something from you.
Well, yeah, on the other hand, like when you don't know anything, your best option is to go, like, can you help me? And then be good enough and respectful enough to listen and ask again if you don't understand, or get on and prove that you do understand. So you have to understand the basic concept of something. Everybody works at a different speed, but really I've found over the years, the better people you're working with, the more honest you are with them, the more kind they are to be able to help you. I think really good people tend to get quite a lot of their skills and power from mentoring other people. I think a lot of what is good, you know, old people, who successful people can go two routes. They can either help other people or they can become egotistical. There's only two places you can go. And so you either sit back and rest on your laurels and go, look how many discs I've got, or you spend your time helping other people because then you learn from them. And most of the people I've been around that were teaching me were just able to help me. And then so I learned how to tune vocals at Stockacre, and I got to work with really great groups and write songs and do stuff and assemble it really quickly, and got taught how to, you know, we were working on 10, 15, 20 songs a day there. We were banging them out. And I just thought, well, if I can do this on the left field, I've started a whole thing. And that's what we did. We just started banging it out. We banged out. We had, basically, my whole career has been Stockacre and Waterman for the left, you know. Big up Pete Waterman, big up, the Matt and Mike.
What's normal for the fly is chaos. No, what's normal for the spider is chaos for the fly.
And the chaos doesn't really come into it, really, because chaos just feels like chaos if you don't know how to cope with, you know, finding your space within it. I was watching my daughter last night, and there's a thing for live musicians called in-ear. And basically you either get everything coming at you through a monitor to listen to what you're singing along to and your own voice, or you have these kind of magic headphones and you can design your own sound. But now getting used to using that...
It's another thing.
You know, yeah. It's like seeing everything in 3D for the first time. It suddenly becomes clear. But you know when you look at your first 3D picture, it doesn't quite work. And then suddenly you work out how to control your muscles in your eyes.
Yeah, so anyway.
It takes about 6 weeks to learn how to do that. My daughters didn't arrive until 1 p.m. yesterday. She did the gig last night at 8 p.m. It took her one song to nail it. I was like...
Damn.
And she turned around. I saw her go half after the first song. I saw her turn her head and smile, and it was there you go. And I was just like, I started crying.
Yeah. And because she sonically had it correct in her
she
head.
She just worked the equation out. She just calmly went, okay, that's not right, but I know this there somewhere. And she could see her just turning her head and turning her head, and then she went, and I saw her smile, and then she just said, because she could.
That's
sing.
The coldest shit. That
it was
a parent.
So cold. And I was like. I just yelled out. She's smiling, Dad.
You must have been gassed. I would have been.
Oh,
so
she
proud.
Was gassed. I recognised. So it was good.
Yeah, I love that. I used to take one ear out because I just couldn't feel the energy of the. It's a mad one. Those
you can get. You can work it out so that the energy is pumped back in.
Yeah.
There's two ways. Michael Stipe from REM taught me that you can drill a hole, but there's another way. I don't know if you guys have ever heard of REM.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Very great singer, Michael Stipe, great songwriter. I was driving along with him in a car once and he wanted to play me something from the tape and my car wouldn't play it, so he just turned around and sang it to me. I just turned around and went, you witch.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He's that guy. Anyway, he taught us how to drill holes in his thing. But I've
and
learned...
And that works? Does it work?
But it's not as good. If you seal it and you go with it and you learn it and you're working with good people, then...
you're good forever.
And yeah, we've got one magic guy that deals with all that stuff called John Tonks, who I nicked off Tricky years and years ago. And he's big up John Tonks. He's the magic guy behind all of the stuff we do live. And he taught us how to just have patience, make time, do the work. And he got Tyson through they just did 2 days rehearsal. He didn't panic. He said, no, keep with the in-ears. It's going to be fine. They'll arrive. The post office will make it work. If not, we'll give you headphones. That's fine. And she just did it. And it's quite scary because they put the stuff in and it seals. And it suddenly goes...
Can't
hear you. And suddenly everything's...
Yeah.
And it's so frightening, and then it's just you, and you sound so loud and out of tune and exposed. Yeah, it's like standing there, stark bollock naked on stage, and she just did it. Bless her.
That's so sick.
Yeah.
You've mentioned Tricky a couple of times. So let's get
Trickstar.
Let's get into the Massive Attack era when you were in Kensal Green, and you again going back to that cottage industry, doing everything from home, the studios there. Tell me about that story, because Naina mentioned it on the last podcast we did with her. You can go.
They live with us.
Yeah, that's it.
We made Blue Lines in the house.
Yeah,
in the
whole
poo
album.
Room.
Yeah.
We called it the poo room because it stank because there was three guys living in it.
Right, so explain the situation. So the room itself, explain the
Well, we managed to buy, with Nana's first publishing advance back in the day, we managed to scrape together the deposit to buy our first house. It's when we sort of, because we were living in a pretty horrendous flat in Cromwell Road or somewhere, and we had some scary neighbour who'd taken too many drugs and was really frightening to be around, and we didn't really like leaving the kids there. And so we bought this house, and of course we couldn't afford to work anywhere because we'd spent all our money. So we started working there, and Nana started being successful. And then Mushroom from Massive Attack was coming up to mind. The Dex 3D was helping us write raps. So we were just meeting people through Nelly, basically, because we were connected to Bristol. Nelly was just introducing us because he's part of our little crew. In fact, Nelly's not part of our crew. He's just an old friend. And so they were headed towards making a record, and they were going to go to the same management that we'd just fallen out with. And we were like, well, that's not going to work. And we needed to be able to pay our Ellie, our PA, because we had the office in the house, the studio in the house, kids on the way, one already existing kids from our previous marriages, blah, blah, blah. So I said to them, come and chill up here. Come and start making some music. I'll show you how to make songs from these little grooves you've got. And we started working, me and Johnny Dollar, God rest his soul. We just started, I brought this engineer in who I've been working with. He was from the kind of talk Radiohead type stuff. And I thought that would work well with the DJ thing. So he came in and started, and then I worked with Will Malone on strings and stuff. We got all these people in that would make it unexpected. They started living in the house and making the record on 2/8 track and stuff. And then... And then basically we did what we thought were going to be demos. They thought were going to be demos. And then they wanted Jazzy and Nelly to present, because they'd had their first hit then. So they wanted Jazzy and Nelly to to produce the record. So we went to Britrose Studios in Hislington, where Jazzy and Nelly had set up camp, mm-hmm. to meet them one evening. And we got there, and as we arrived, Jazzy said, "I'll be back in a minute." And he went out on a date for dinner, and we were all sat there for like 2.5 hours. And in the end, they just turned around and went, "Jack, don't you make records? Fuck this guy. Let's fucking leave."
Really?
And we went off, and that's how I ended up producing the record. I'd been wanting to, but I didn't like to, because I'd been helping them with their business. I didn't want to suggest
it. Kind of like got guided along and not be too in the way.
And then Dollar was in there, and then we kind of did it, and then we did another whole lot of stuff down in Bristol. So I moved kind of within 20 minutes drive of where they were. I didn't want too close back. So
I worked. What happened, Jazzy? You missed your opportunity for girls, you know?
Yeah, it was a bit funny because, I mean, I don't know why. Maybe Jazzy didn't want to do it.
Yeah, maybe it's just one of them, isn't it? Yeah,
maybe, because Nelly made the second one on his own. He didn't do it with Jazzy. And I think, because I think Blue Lines wouldn't have been Blue Lines if they'd done it. And then I think that the second record was great. And I think the two worked really well together. So we kind of complimented each
other. You kind of helped, fair bit, Massive Attack, come on. But for you to bring in, have the idea of bringing in strings and more kind of, like you say, Radiohead-esque influences, that essentially formed a genre, dude.
You've got to be able to not be... Like, I like R&B, I love rap, I love reggae music, I love punk, I love jazz, and I love orchestral music, I love rock, I love a cappella music, love beatbox, innit?
Yeah, you do.
But it's like, for me... Like, it's the more shit you can get into the cooking and get away with it, the more interesting the meal, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, obviously, you don't want to crowd the room with every track, but you definitely want to have a little flavour, so...
Do you ever think a lot about frequencies
a lot.
And, you know, the space in a tune?
And that annoys a lot of the people I work with, because they think, well, what do you know? But, like, I kind of... Yeah, I do. And I kind of think... Nelly, again, he's come up... Nelly, you've come up a lot in this, huh? Nell's... taught me once. He said to me one day, "You know what? It's fucking weird, isn't it?" He said, "When we're going to make a record, every time you just basically, it's like you've never done it before." And I just went, "You just nailed it." That's the thing. It's like whenever I go in a room, it's like, why are we here? What are we doing? What do I do? Mm. And that is what makes it
playful.
Yeah, it makes it work, you know. And it's just like, because everything is different. I mean, yeah, there are things that are the same. The desk is the same and blah, blah, blah. But fundamentally, every single thing you do is different, right?
It's part of the energy that makes the record what it is compared to... Do you think that... Because, obviously, Massive Attack, you had the home studio, where I guess you were able to create and perfect certain things and repeat them until they worked and more time to do stuff. But like you say, when you've got the bigger studios, it's like you go into the unknown and it's like...
Maybe this is a bit dangerous territory, right? But, I mean, like, for me... Dictaphones are really important because you want to capture that first moment, and you never... I remember the first time I heard One Love, which is one of the tunes on Blue Lines, and Horace Andy singing it, and he basically had set up the backing track that Mush had made, and he'd recorded that on a ghetto blaster in his room with his then girlfriend, playing along on a keyboard roughly, and he sang and recorded the sound of that into another ghetto blaster in the room. And it goes, "One love, it's you I love, and not another." And he's got that mad Horace Andy, old school.
Batman.
Big up Sleepy Man. Anyway, and it was me that put him in there, because Dick Jewell, big up Dick Jewell, great artist from back in the day. Dick Jewell used to run the label that brought in Dennis Brown and Gregory Isaacs and all those kids back in the day when he was still at Royal College of Art. And he introduced me to Horace, so that's how we put Horace into Massive Attack, because they wanted a classic old reggae thing. I don't know Horace. I knew Jackie Mitto, I knew all those guys. And so then he was singing that, and I remember I was driving across from Chippenham, where we were staying on a little farmhouse we'd rented. I was driving over on the old Bath and on the A4, and there were balloons coming up, because there's a lot of ballooning down that way, and it was sunset, because I would work at night a lot of the time.
Okay.
And I remember hearing it on my car stereo. I just bought myself my first brand new car. It was a Volvo Estates, you know, family business. And I remember driving with that in the car stereo, hearing Horace's voice, thinking, how the fuck am I going to make it sound as good as this ever? And that is record production. Because then I had to spend ages in a real recording studio making it sound as fucked as that thing. And in the end, I ended up, you know, like, I think I failed, because it never sounded as good as the demo, you know what I mean? And I think that, like, that's a lot of the thing that you do, is just like that original first moment when people shave things off. And when we did Blue Lines, we did most of the record up in the Poo Room up in London, and we'd go down and we'd work for ages trying to recreate tracks to make it sound more technically adept. I'd wait for them to go home and I'd take the demo and don't tell anyone and put it onto the 2-inch. So quite a lot of people set up their studio with saying, "Oh, it's an amazing technical album, you know, we set up a studio." I would copy in 1/2-inch and 1/4-inch 8-track Fostex onto 2-inch with the compression going. And people think that that's technically like really, I'm like, yeah, you know, it's a secret. I can't really let on. You know what I mean? It's like, you're not supposed to do that for you readers at home. And and that's what made that record sound so fucking crusty, was the fact I was just copying chunks of it off the demo.
I've said this a bunch of times on the podcast, and I think you're a great person to throw this at. Producers tend to be, I mean, apart from like this, like they love to somewhat almost treat their experiences in the studio like they're inventing the wheel.
Ah, oh, fuck that.
But they also are on the plus of some of the most prompt, timekeeping human beings that, you know, kind of put us artists in line. Be on time.
I was a day late, babe. What are you talking about?
apart from podcast is different.
I don't wear a watch, man.
Do you think so? Do you think that's the case that without the producer, the writers would run riot, wouldn't they?
I think, the thing is now, because the producers, everyone's a producer, aren't they? So it's different. Yeah, back in the day, we were supposed to be like schoolmasters, but I wasn't part of that brigade because I didn't come through that route. So, like, I don't care. I mean,
you seemed a lot more casual than
that. Nana reminded me last night about the sound of us lot in the studio in the middle of the night, me and Dave Allen running amok in the studio while she was trying to sleep, having our second baby, you know what I mean, with Mabel. And, you know, it's chaos. I mean, the chaos, the parties, the fun, the good times, the sad times, they're all part of the equation, you know, and that's what makes stuff so real. And demos make great records. Mm. And anyone who tells you different is talking shit. Because when you first do something, that's why I've got this rule, right? I don't let people leave the studio telling me they're going to do the second verse tomorrow. No, you do the verse now, babe, because we're going to forget why we were here, and it won't be like it's about the same thing. Oh, no, it's fine. I'm running out of time. I've got no. I'm sorry, but you're not leaving.
Yeah. Get it done because you won't match it.
No, man. When we did Unfinished Sympathy, I wouldn't let anyone leave the room for a piss, even.
That's an important fundamental.
And we were short of a single. Ashley Newton said, you need a single, the guy, the A&R man from Circa. And I was like, okay. We went into the little room next to it was the rehearsal room next to the Coach House Studios. And I said, we're going to make a tune. They started the thing. I wouldn't let anyone, no one was allowed to leave the room. People were desperate. And it got done. And that's what you have to do. Because I just thought, this is going to go off. It's not going to work. People are going to be. And then people were just like, take the chorus. I remember Freddie, because I wrote this naff chorus. And he was like, that's bollocks. I don't take it out. And he went, and he took it out because he was desperate for a piss. You know what I mean? So he took it out. And he was right. My chorus was so shit. And then it's just got the sample. And it's brilliant, right?
Yeah.
3D. Big up 3D. Hey, that was Delge, man, sitting there going, your chorus is bollocks. I'm like, what do you mean?
Wow.
He was angry because he needed a Jimmy Riddle. And he was right.
That's hilarious. So Unfinished Sympathy.
I wish I could remember my question. It was so terrible.
Unfinished Sympathy was the way it was because Treedy was desperate for a
gym. Yeah, he wanted a Waz man. And when we were doing that record, at that part of the record, he tried every single room in the studio for his vocals, and he ended up doing all vocals in the car seat because that's where he felt at home.
Yeah, that's what Nana said, that this was the thing. They would go into.
When we had the fairlight in the toilet upstairs in our house in Mortimer Road. So you had to piss across, so the fairlight had yellow right across the top of the brain of the fairlight. No. And we did vocals in there. No, we did the vocals in the house outside where Nana was feeding Tyson on the landing there, because that was the best place where Dollar thought that. There's actually a tape of Dollar, because Dollar got attacked by one of the singers. Because he was a boxer and he didn't like being pushed around. So there's me separating them, trying to stop Dollar from getting killed. And then there's another one subsequent to that where Nana was doing a track that we were working on, and I tried to prod her in the abdomen and she'd not long given birth. And you can hear her hitting me with the mic stand. Dollar kept a dat of me being a you fucking rah-rah, dish the binga. And I got beat the fuck. I had bruises for weeks. She picked up a fucking white thing and slashed me. I fell down the stairs. Dollar recorded it. I could hear him chuckling while I was getting blows.
Again, sample packs will be available soon.
Yeah, you know.
Dude.
So that's my production
skills.
You do
know that people listening to this, right, you know, these accounts of what went down, which... so seismic.
You know, I didn't get credited as producer on Blue Lines.
Why is that?
Because because they said it's kind of, because I was managing at the time, which was a nightmare. But like, you know, like I didn't care. So I said, well, okay, you didn't call me the executive producer because that means nothing. And so Dollar got the only production credit. And, you know, bless him, I don't care. Because he was the sort of person that needed the work and I didn't. And the executive producer means nobody, basically. Mm-hmm. It's the twat.
Just financing something.
Whatever.
Like, well, managers get that, don't they? They get those kind of credits.
Sometimes, yeah. But and I was fine with it. And so these days I still, you know, I mean, obviously I did the production, but it was like, it just doesn't matter. The worst thing about being credited for something is someone's going to ask you to recreate the thing you got credited for.
True.
And who wants to do what you've already done? You know what I mean? I want to do something out of nowhere. And then you've got to live off your rep, which means you're going to get people treating you in a way which is... So, like, right now, I'm just some old weird guy that comes in the studio. No one knows. The kids don't know who the fuck I am, and that's great. And I'm some weird guy, and I say, why is he there? You know, and eventually maybe something happens, and they go, oh, that was amazing. Mm. And you go, well, okay.
See you later.
Yeah.
Bye. My time here's done. Mabel, do you go into the studio in those situations where she's creating an album?
No. She's pretty out there on her own now. I mean, she came through some pretty strict... training in Stockholm when she was going to school. So what was that? 2004, we moved out of London. So she was young and she'd just seen me. What had I just done? Back to back Sugar Babes and All Saints first albums. So that was the first time I was in pop mode, but I was in pop mode because my kids were the right age. So when Mabel was kind of into pop, that's when I did Babes. So I used to take her to the studio. She was really young, but she would just go, I like that one, I don't like that one. And then when Tyson was the same age, she was kind of helping me with All Saints. And then we moved to Sweden because Tyson wasn't getting on for school. So we moved to Sweden and they all learned to speak Swedish because they didn't speak Swedish in the house, even though it's Nana's first language, but she never taught them Swedish. And then they went to school in Sweden and then Mabel ended up at a school that was based around music. So did Tyson actually as well. And then they both kind of got their chops there. And then when it came down to time to get ready, we moved back. Tyson moved back first to go to uni. Mabel moved back with her mum about a year after I moved back. I went back to set up and then she came back. And then she started saying, I want to make fucking... Well, first before that, Oscar Scheller, big up Oscar. He flew over and worked with Mabel just to get her started. And then she came to London and she did a bit of work. And then she just got really like, I need to do this. And we found, I can't remember who it was, but we found something on SoundCloud that we both liked. And I noticed that the manager was listed. So I rang up the manager and blackmailed him into taking a meeting. And I said, you'll never have to see me again if you take her on. And they just loved her and they took her on, gave her her first couple of chances in the studio. And then she kind of did it on her own after that. And then she met Rada, her current manager, via Grace LaJoa, big up Grace, big up Rada, and congrats on the new baby Grace, and they started doing their own thing, and I'm only really there to fire people, really. That's my job.
Right, okay, so this junction,
you want to sing in a studio with your dad going,
no, but you know, with the
plus she's running today, you don't tell Mabel nothing.
She's on her grind,
she can punch too, you don't want to get in the way, but punch.
But
same with Tyson, I can't really, you know, I mean, poor old Tyson, she's been on the road with mum and dad. I mean, how degrading is that? But I mean, maybe a bit better with mum than with mum and dad. But she sang, Nana did backing vocals and Tyson and me did lead vocals. I mean, poor chick.
There's got to be a side to Cameron that, you know, get her on the books and I won't call you again. Kind of, those kind of conversations... You're my mate, but I would also...
No, the worst thing is if the threat of me is that's what I'm thinking. Anything for anyone.
So,
if you
where
don't
does that come
fucking
from?
Do it, Cameron.
Where's that
do
come
that?
From? Where's that come from?
I suppose I come from quite, you know, my family. There's a part of my family that are from Bethnal Green and we know what that is.
Yeah.
And I suppose, you know, I'm just so belligerent and horrible and emphatic that you just don't want me in a conversation because I just won't shut up.
God, I love it. I'm so glad you're on my side, baby. I'm so glad.
Well, you've seen me go off. I mean, it's like, you know, and you know, when
and it works, it's effective. Yeah. You know, it's like,
and plus the business is so full of people who know nothing and get involved and stop people being creative and try and tell you it's because the whole thing about the record business, the corporate side of it, is they want everything to be like the thing before that was successful. Yeah. When history dictates that, then the thing that's unique is the thing that's going to sell the most and last the longest. So why they get there from there is beyond my comprehension. And in fact, we just went into this thing with this manager guy who I was told was going to really help Nana with the kind of where we were trying to get to. And I didn't really want to run the business. And he just came, every single thing he came with was a derivative thing of something I'd already seen. And it was just like, what? Shut up. The whole thing about Nana is she's unique. Just let her just...
Let swan be a swan, man.
He got the fuck fired really quick.
Did he?
Yeah.
He got the fuck fired. Get the fuck out of here.
I'm good at firing people. I can make people feel wanted after they've been fired. I mean, firing people is really difficult because you're breaking their heart.
Yeah.
But if you fuck up, you've got to be fired.
Yeah. I've heard these. There's a theory to this. It's like hiring people's easy. Firing people, you've got to know.
When you go into things with someone, you've got to make them understand that there is a potential it might not work out.
at its core, that's because
you have
that's the extra edge that allows them to be on there.
I'm just bringing in this kid now who's related to me from Copenhagen, who's going to go and work with my goddaughter, who's really talented. Mm. And I'm, you know, she's worried that the responsibility, obviously, the first thing she's going to think is, well, what if it doesn't work out? So I've got to tell him coming in, this probably won't work out, dude. And I'm going to tell you to fuck off. So. Mm.
Do you do that a lot? Do you give people the forewarning?
Yeah, definitely.
Because that gives people the edge, game, doesn't it?
They've got to. There's no point because shock is, you know, there's nothing worse than post-traumatic stress.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? So it's like if you don't warn people that, and it's not to keep people on their toes, it's just that there has to be clarity. And there's so much, especially now I'm seeing people dying already, you know, because we're at that age now when people are dropping, and you're seeing all of the history that everyone tells you was the reason that they're pissed off and you did this and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, really? Cool. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
If that's really where your head's at, I mean, I feel bad that you even can be asked to think of that, because when it was over, it was over.
Yeah.
And it was great. And everything we did was great. And you remember that? One, I don't agree that it happened, but I ain't even going to go there. The point is, I'm not even going to follow your Instagram anymore, bitch, because fucking, what's the point? Because you're just being negative, man.
So do you think that's, why put that kind of pressure on you as well? What's that, where's that
people
come from?
People just do it to themselves because they're kind of, people think that, you know, look, creativity, a conduit is like a drain pipe, right? Something through, a vessel through which water passes is a conduit. Anything through, so a drain pipe's a conduit. So if you think about creativity coming from the gutter, it's the water, and it's got to flow to the recipient, which is the drain at the bottom. People who constrict the flow of the water through the conduit, through the drain pipe, are basically taking it or trying to take ownership of the creativity. We don't own anything. These are just ideas that come into our head, but they existed everywhere. They're not ours. I mean, I didn't make blue. It's not mine. I didn't make the noise that came out of my mouth. That came from the miracle of life. If you start saying, oh, it's mine, that's why I never keep my discs and all that shit, because it's like, that's looking back. You know, you just want, you know, yeah, I was okay, I remember doing that, but Nana's writing a book and I really have trouble remembering anything. And it's not ours to own, right?
I think
the people that think that it's theirs and are jealous because they think you've stolen their limelight and blah, 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 really, obviously. Okay.
But you know where that is? I think because you're a team leader, you're a motivator, and there has to be someone there. And there has to be someone to take the slack.
Some things I am, yeah, but I mean, it's like, here's an example. Lockdown starts, I'd been on holiday, came back, and suddenly we needed to come together as a family. We decided as a group that we weren't going to go to the family stronghold, which is in Skåne, which is in a region of the south of Sweden, which is where Nana's mother built the place for people to go at the end of the world. But we couldn't get there, and it felt a bit like, okay, this is too much of a throb. And it was hard to get the kids, even though they're adults now, to all believe it was going to go like it was going to go. So then we had to take our little ex-council house in underneath Trellick and make that into a place where everyone was going to come back and be as a group. Now, so obviously Mabel was kicking off, Tyson was kicking off, Nana was kicking off in their careers. So it's there's a kitchen, there's a studio in what was the garage, there's a first floor, which is a lounge, then there's a bedroom where Panda, Nana's sister, and who works with Mabel, she sleeps. And there's two bedrooms at the top. So Tyson and, well, in fact, Mabel was being mobile between the two sisters, the auntie and the sister. And Tyson was at the top. Nana and I are in the bedroom. Mabel's got TikTok going off, like, so we had to have the living room as a full-time TikTok studio. Tyson and Mabel between them are running the studio, so they were literally just that. I couldn't get in there.
Wow.
And I'm thinking, okay, so I'm not working in the kitchen because Nana's running her business from there. So fundamentally, I've got my meditation chair in the corner of my bedroom, and we're going to probably be locked down for a year. And I just went, well, okay, what can happen? And so then you just go, okay, well, I can do this on the internet. I can grab that. I can do this. And then I've got my music going. I've got a little table and starting. And you get this thing going on and you just start bringing it in. Now, I brought it in to help a load of people who were around me and to help myself from going nuts, right? And then they started to look towards me as being the team leader. And I'm like, whoa, this isn't that now. We're the co-op now. No? You guys have got to take some responsibility. Now, first lockdown ended, and we're ready to ship, and we're going to ship to the said house. But Nana and I now decide to go and leave the kids in London because they know how to do lockdown now. They decide still not to come. We're going to go. So we bought a dodgy car, drove this left-hand drive car to Sweden all in one hit. And basically set up shop there for like 6, 7, 8, 9 months, whatever. And then kind of did the same thing again, running the same thing, you know, running a few projects, making some music, blah, blah, blah. Now I'm back. Where are we now? It's what, June, blah, 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 11, 10, 9, 10.
Yeah, right.
So we're back for this time and everyone's still looking to me about why, you know, stuff. And I'm going, whoa, your thing's happening. You're doing this, but now you have to run this and you need to go and do this and blah, blah. And stop treating me like I'm not a fucking piece of elastic. You've all got to step up now and do that. And they're starting to realize, oh shit, yeah, you're right, you know. Because that's, you can't be leaning on everything all the time. You've got to be, and you've got to teach people to, I think the most important thing that a person can do, a mentor, a producer, an elder, is teach people how to stand alone. A parent. Yeah. Letting go of your kittens, letting go of your puppies is difficult. But you know what dogs do? They start fucking attacking them to get them the fuck out of the nest. Come the time. You see the mum, she turns on the kids. It's like they will literally go down, buy a fish, get a fish from the dock and bring it back to their puppy. And then 6 weeks later, it will kill the puppy if the puppy doesn't get them fucking do it themselves. And, you know, and that's...
Well, that's it. Tough love.
Well, I think that's the nature. But humans are not like that. You know, me and Nan are going away, like, tomorrow. And we're like, maybe we should put it off for a week. And it's like, I'm worse than her.
You would rather just hold
I just don't know what
you guys, man, I inspires a show, I mean, you guys, and always have done ever since I've met you. The Bohemian, the way that you guys
come on, we're in your
artistry.
Amazing, inspiring studio, and look at what you
totally,
do.
Totally. But this, all of this, the majority of this is loosely based on the grid system that I adopted through meeting the characters like yourself, and you feel things out. Dave Baby's a great example as well, who just embodies his art. He does his thing, and there's no one else like him. No one will ever be like him.
No, he's literally. He's literally the best at what he does that's ever been.
Yeah.
There hasn't been, literally, I mean, in history, there's never been an artist as pure and unassuming.
Yeah.
He made me a wooden, well, he didn't make it for me, but he made a wooden, it was, Judy hung it on a piece of cord, and it was a piece of wood.
Yeah.
And it was looked like a flower, but actually it was a clitoris and a vagina. But you
standard.
Didn't, do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And I said to him one day, why do you only ever make dicks and pussies? You know, and he went, well, you know, it's wood, isn't it, Cam? He said, either, you know, it's either a pole or a hole. I mean,
<That's> and
if you think about it, you're right. And that's how genius Dave Baby is.
It's true. And these are the you guys have created the DNA of like what I feel like real artistry is about, and you live it, you breathe it, you pass on information, you know like you say, the conduits that the don't get in the way.
But don't you find that being able to just be there with each other is part of it? I mean, without that, doesn't it mean that we just stop to function? I would be a complete blubber
on your own, innit? Yeah, that would suck.
I mean, I can spend time on my own, but it's like, if I didn't have all of you lot, and if I didn't have connections with you all, and if I didn't have this wonderful view now as an older person, because I'm kind of, you know, I can nearly get my old, I get bus pass now, and you know, like, see you lot doing what you all do, and I'm so proud that I've watched you all grow up. You know what I'm saying? And you know, you really make me proud. I was just watching your interviewing skills just then, thinking, oh, he's keeping me on track.
Go.
Super pro.
Yeah, no, but it takes time, doesn't it? And time is one thing that we do have. It's the biggest currency we have as artists.
It is, and although life is short.
Yeah, I know, that's right.
I've, you know, there's enough people in West London Cemetery that shouldn't be there, right?
Yeah, for sure.
I fucking hate that place. And it's like, I was working in a studio, really great studio that overlooks the back end of it. It's actually on Scrubs Lane. It's one of the warehouses in Scrubs Lane. So when you go out to the back balcony for a Zubby, and you're looking out over where Sean's buried and, you know, Sean Oliver and loads of people, and you look at it and just, it puts you in your place, man, when you're making a
record. Freddie Mercury's around there as well, isn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So many famous people in that cemetery.
Madness, isn't it? No, not madness, though. Not madness. Legendary
put out a film, right?
I know, that's right. Madness, right? And again, there's also documentation that suggests that they were some of the most earliest graffiti writers in the UK.
You know, they're a cunning bunch of wolves. I love them. We
Fantastic.
Had a, it was fun. I still know so many funny stories about that. Like, that's another podcast for later.
Yeah, that's a whole different thing.
You know, I still see Carl quite a bit because I bump into him in Ibiza and I'm in touch with Chrissy quite a lot on the internet. But those are the two I communicate with the most, because she just writes to me, and Kyle I see because we hang out together there a bit. But they were great. Watching them do what they did was amazing.
Northwest London has a lot of creative pockets and moments in history, hasn't it?
A I guess, yeah.
Crazy when you think about the hip hop movement and, you know, Trellick, you know,
AJ Tracy now, you know, Tracy Northwest 10.
Yeah, AJ Tracy.
Well, W10, sorry.
Labrook Grove, yeah.
Yeah, he's W10 through and through. And him and Mabel are well tight, man. They're proper like W10ers.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah, people think it's a bit whack and a bit kind of retired people, but actually the scene is quite, you know.
Yeah. There's a whole scene going on down, particularly around Labrador Grove and all that area. Like new rappers, new artists.
Yeah, Maxi's there out. You know, there's a big R&B thing going on now.
Mm.
And then you've got there's good things going on. Mm. There's good things. I just saw the Specials in the studio recording an album.
It's just a little bit too casual for me.
In West London.
Where? How?
I got a phone call because they wanted Nana to sing on a track, but unfortunately she couldn't do it, but she didn't have time. But so I went to see them. I saw Horace and I saw Lindell. I saw Terry. Yeah, they were all there. I was like, nothing's changed.
Really?
Yeah, working in the Great East Coast Studios, you know, one of the great establishments of West London.
Mm.
Yeah, and then Psalm's up for sale now.
Is it up for sale?
Yeah.
Psalm is very big for those outside the London, into Zone 7. Psalm is a very, very, very...
Well, it used to be Basing Street Studios. The telephone number was 229-1229.
Really?
Yeah, that was the old Marley room. That was where all the great Bob Marley records were made. And then it became Trevor Horn Studio when it got retitled to Psalm. And then Psalm got sold to build some houses. And then they put a kind of production room office building in Ladbroke Grove, which got called Psalm as well. And now that's up for sale. The original one was on, at the back of Lancaster Road.
Gary Barlow's got the old Nelly Hooper studio just off Salisbury Road.
Yeah.
That's right, isn't it?
That was a den of iniquity when Nelly was there.
I used to love that place.
Yeah, man, it's pop and nice.
Yeah. I
haven't seen Nels for a long time, actually. I need to see him. I haven't seen him for years. And for some reason, our paths haven't crossed. But yeah, there's a man you should interview.
Yeah, well, man. I mean, everyone you just pretty much run off there, I was just like, yeah, I'll chat with Cameron about that one. Any regrets before we go?
Yeah, I wish I'd never taken drugs. I wish I'd never drunk. I wish I'd never raised my voice in anger. I wish I'd been faster to learn the things that I just was spouting off about. I wish that I had, I wish I'd been around when certain records were made just to watch. I wish my mum was still alive. Yeah, of course. Yeah. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do.
I wish my dad was still alive. My dad died when I was 16. I miss him still, you know. Amazing man. I wish that Preeti Patel could learn some of the shit that we know and could turn around and surprise us.
Mm-hmm.
I wish that Joe Biden wasn't sending all those arms to Israel because that doesn't feel right. I wish that we had concentrated more on letting the world be a proper place. If you think about what Britain did when it divided up, when it partitioned India, when it gave away Palestine, when it divided all of those areas, we've not been great, have we?
No. And we don't admit to it neither a lot of times.
And then as far as personal regrets, I just wish I wasn't such an asshole.
Well, you ain't an asshole, brother.
Think,
you're not.
I mean, we always wish we could do better, and I just wish I wasn't such a tosser. I think that it's good to think that you're a tosser because that's a good place to come from. If you look in the mirror and go, you're all right, mate, you know, every day and know you're all right, but then go, yeah, but you're still a cunt. You know what I mean? I think that's a good place.
The legend. Cameron McVie inside the place, and brother, it's been everything I wanted.
No, thank you very much. I wouldn't do this for anyone else, you know that. Yeah. I've only ever done two interviews. One was at the American ambassador's residence for a friend of mine's who used to be one of the Sony gods. I did it for him and I really regretted it afterwards because they weren't as professional as you. So that's true. That's not me just winding him.
My guy.
Bless you.
Thank you so much for passing through.
Thank you for putting up with
me. My boy, Cameron, thank you so much, my brother. Listen, you know, the curse. I'm going to give it straight from the horse's mouth here. Killer Cow Podcast. Caring is sharing. Don't forget to share, all right? Spread the good word. Don't talk to anybody I wouldn't. Stay lucky, people.
It's all love.
Peace.
That was good, man.